Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
This is indeed terrorism. We cannot call this any other name.
A shopping center filled with women and children, Russia's latest civilian target in Ukraine. And as the death toll and suffering there grow, the First Lady, Olena Zelenska, joins me for a rare interview. Then, the NATO summit declares Russia its greatest threat. Former Deputy NATO Commander Richard Sheriff joins me on its beefed-up posture for the future. And
when we look back to the 1950s and 1960s, there actually was a very vibrant movement among clergy to assist women to get abortions.
So what changed? Historian Carissa Hogeberg joins Walter Isaacson with a look at the surprising past and the uncertain future. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. As Russia's war on Ukraine enters its fifth month, constant reminders that it is being mostly waged against soft targets. That means civilians. Today, President Zelensky called the attack on a shopping center one of the most defiant terrorist acts in European history. Search and rescue operations continue, but at least 18 people are confirmed dead, with many, many more wounded. The Russians, for their part, stick to familiar lines, claiming that their strike targeted Western weapons and ammunition. It came just as Western leaders assembled in Europe for G7 and NATO summits to show renewed strength and unity for Ukraine. Zelensky says the enemy has marked him as target number one and his family as number two. But neither he nor First Lady Olena Zelenska is cowering in fear. Like him, she is busy on many fronts, rallying the world to Ukraine's cause, supporting her people during this devastating war, and being a mother to two children. Zelenska met her husband when they were just kids. And in a TV exclusive now from Kyiv, she tells me their relationship is on pause, like so many other families fighting for their nation's survival. First Lady Olena Zelenska, welcome to our program.
Hello, Christiane, and thank you for inviting me to do this interview.
Well, I'm really happy to talk to you, but obviously it comes at a very sad moment for you, for your country, and a moment where yet again everybody realizes that anybody can be a target. After that missile attack on the mall, Kremenchuk, you know, nearly 20 people dead. What is your reaction to that? How are ordinary people reacting to that?
Well, of course, we cannot react in any other way than be shocked. This is indeed terrorism. We cannot call this any other name. Yesterday in Kremenchuk, more than 1,000 people were in the shopping mall. This is an ordinary shopping mall. There were children and adults there, and you've just said how many people died. We still don't know their final number. We are all shocked. And unfortunately, we are shocked yet again in this war. We were shocked many times. I don't know what else the occupiers can shock us with.
So let me ask you, it is now into the fifth month of this war. Your husband, the president, told the G7 leaders that this war had to be ended by the end of this year. Can I ask you about morale, your morale, your children's morale, the people's morale? Because everybody's been so impressed by the heroic resistance that Ukraine has mounted. But what is the morale 5 months in now?
You know, in the first weeks and months, we were like sprinters. We were doing a short run at high speed. We gave it 200%. But now everybody now is running a marathon. We need to calculate our strength. We need to hold on. As you said, it's very difficult to hold on for 5 months. We cannot see physically or mentally. We cannot see the end of our suffering. So we need to accumulate our strength. We need to save our energy. And all Ukrainians must do it. It's very difficult for all of us. And we are trying to find joy in simple things. Maybe stroke a cat or do something simple. But we all look forward for this war to end.
That's really poignant what you say. Try to do simple and beautiful things. How do you specifically feel about your safety? We know you told us when we last talked over email in April that at the beginning of the war, it happened. You barely were able to say goodbye to your husband. He sent you and the kids somewhere else in Ukraine to be safe. Now, I understand you can come back to Kyiv more often, more regularly. How do you specifically feel about yours and your family's safety?
Yes, fortunately, those 2 months when I didn't see my husband at all, that's in the past. I can see him sometimes for a short time and not very often, but I can physically feel him next to me. This isn't normal. It's not a normal relationship when children cannot see their father and have to talk to him on the phone. So our relationship is on pause, just as it is for many, well, all Ukrainians. I would say that half of our population are apart, are not together, and we, just like every family, are waiting to be reunited, to be together again, to spend evenings, to have dinner together, to talk to the children about their things, and not only their children's things, but my daughter, for example, is a young adult now. But we're hanging in. I like this image. We're holding on just like that cupboard in Borodyanka when the occupiers bombed a building and bombed all the buildings there. And we saw this photo of one of the buildings, and there was a wall remaining, and there was a wardrobe or a cupboard there that stood undamaged. So we're holding on. We're telling each other, how are you? I'm like that cupboard in Borodyanka. So I'm trying to hold on just like that cupboard.
It's amazing you say that, because I witnessed that myself in Borodyanka, and we filmed it and we broadcast it. The cupboard, the table, the chair, the coat that was still remaining. So it was a still life. Tell me, you've just spoken about your daughter. Tell me about your son. He's much younger, and obviously the war, he's not being sheltered from it. He knows what's going on. What does he think about weapons, soldiers, about the military unfolding on the ground?
You know, there isn't much you can hide from our children these days, and I'm not going to hide it. He lives in the same information space as me. As a boy, he is interested in military affairs, and he is watching our action, the arrival of weapons from our partners, just like all Ukrainians. He knows about it all, about all kinds of guns that we're using. And on the one hand, it is a boy's dream about heroic feats. But on the other hand, it's very sad that my child is growing up like this, that we were raising our children. We weren't raising them for war. We were raising them for peace. We wanted them to see their future without a war. So we are very much hoping that this military mood will somehow change to a peaceful one, and that he can imagine our life, and that we can put our life on a peaceful footing.
Tell me about your work with mental health, in other words, the challenges faced by children and women in Ukraine right now, especially since there does seem to be a stigma in many parts of your world on the issue of mental health. There doesn't seem to be, you know, like in the United States or elsewhere, as many mental health providers. Is that a challenge?
Yes, you're right. Maybe this is something to do with the history of our country. Many people, especially elderly people, they lived under the Soviet Union when there was no quality mental health assistance at the time, and many of them see something like this as whenever they see a word that has the prefix psycho there, they feel this is something wrong, and we need to overcome this stigma, and we need to make people realize that if they are unwell mentally, they need to seek specialist help. But I think stigma is about the elderly. That's more of the older generation. Younger people like me have a different attitude, and indeed they will seek and they do need a mental health assistance. We can see people who saw the death of their loved ones who were held under occupation or maybe in captivity. Many of them are children, and many can have post-traumatic stress. So all of that needs to be diagnosed, and we need to treat this. So we have a national program for mental health assistance, and we are trying to minimize the consequences of this horrific war for our society and for every person.
Last year, you organized a conference, First Ladies and First Gentlemen, in Kyiv. And you're trying to do it again this year, or you say you will do it again this year. Tell me what it will be about, what you're trying to achieve.
Thank you for this question. It is important for me because last year, at last, we succeeded in creating this professional union, if you could say, for First Ladies and First Gentlemen, because until then, there was no such association. And this enabled me in the first months to also get help from our first ladies for our humanitarian programs. So, yeah, we want to continue this again. And, of course, when the war is on, of course, not everybody can come physically. So we are trying to have a hybrid format. So those who can join us by video, then they will do so. There will be big video links between cities, and we will be discussing human resources, human capital. What can a person endure after such a crisis that we are undergoing?
It's really important, and your country and yourself and your husband, the president, have done so much to keep Ukraine connected with the rest of the world. And of course, since the beginning of the war, we've all noticed and we've all watched and listened to the president's speeches every night that he does with selfies or his film. I just wanted to know, because you are a writer yourself, and you've had not just a personal union, but a professional union during your husband's entertainment career. You're a writer. What do you think of those speeches?
Thank you for your question. I'm not a literary writer. I worked on screenplays, and it was a television show. Of course, I understand how a speech can be improved to reach out to people, but truly, my husband doesn't need help. He knows what he needs to say and how to say it. Sometimes I, as everybody else, I am too impressed, and I think this was a very good idea. He is in touch with Ukrainians every night, and everybody knows that he is in post, he's on duty, and they find out important information from him that they need to know in order to maintain calm and to go to bed peacefully and with the hope that everything will be all right in the morning.
First Lady Olena Zelenska, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, and goodbye.
And the grit of the Ukrainian people has been a source of inspiration, as we said, to people all over the world. Volunteers are fanning out across that country to deliver urgently needed supplies, sometimes dangerously close to the fighting. Correspondent Ben Wiedemann takes us on a rescue ride.
Yulia and her friends are loading up their armored van. Food, medicine, water for frontline villages. That and protective gear for the troops. Before the war, Yulia was a model and worked in local government. Now she's a volunteer. I didn't consider leaving as an option, she says. Of course, I'm staying in my country to help as much as possible. During a drive back from the front in May, Yulia was badly injured when her truck crashed under shelling. She spent 2 restless months in hospital. They were holding me in hospital and I told them I have work to do, she recalls. I was coordinating deliveries on the phone. I had no right to sit on my hands.
Slava Ukraine!
First stop on this day, a military position by the road. All of this has been donated by people in Ukraine. Here, the troops offer a quick appraisal of world leaders.
Boris Johnson.
What about Biden?
Joe Biden, yes.
Joe Biden.
Olaf Scholz.
Scholz. Ще ми не читак, читак ми нічого не знаємо.
Вони нас тут всіх фотографують.
The next stop, a village perilously close to the fighting.
They have to hand out the aid as quickly as possible because they don't want people to get together because we're just a few kilometers from Russian lines.
Spirits here still buoyant. I stayed because of the animals, Natasha tells me. I'm responsible for all the abandoned animals on this street. More than 50 cats and around 20 dogs. At our final stop, they drop off more supplies for the soldiers and feed stray dogs. They had planned to evacuate a family fleeing from behind Russian lines, but they didn't show up. The soldiers here say overnight there was heavy shelling, Russian drones often on the prowl overhead. My mind tells me I should be afraid, says Yulia, but we can't leave them behind. Then is a dog and 2 litters of puppies born in the trenches. One of the mother dogs was killed by Russian artillery. The little ones, orphans. Once loaded, we're off to the city of Zaporizhia. We're out of the danger zone. Once we get to the city, they'll take the mother, who's been injured in a blast, to a vet. They found homes for some of these puppies, but not all.
Ben Wiedemann there with the tale of the endless motivation of Ukrainian people and indeed the fighters. Now today, President Macron said that Putin cannot and should not win this war. And at the NATO summit in Madrid, the allies will stress that Russia poses, quote, the most significant threat to their security. So they're rolling out plans to bolster their defense posture. It's the biggest upgrade since the Cold War. 300,000 more troops will be deployed on the eastern flank and shifted into high alert. Joining me now is General Sir Richard Sheriff. He was deputy military commander of NATO when Putin first invaded back in 2014. And welcome back to our program, General Sheriff. We really want to know, because we've talked to you so many times, about the lay of the land and what you've been calling for a long time, to show a proper deterrent force. Does this do it now by NATO leaders?
Let's not underestimate this. This is a massive shift by NATO. It's what many of us have been calling for. And it's absolutely what is needed to demonstrate to Putin that NATO is ready to take the risks inherent in supporting Ukraine. We might come back to that in a minute. Is it going to be enough? Now that all depends on the political leaders of NATO. Are they really prepared to put their money where their mouths are? Because be under no illusions, this is going to require profound and far-reaching will have profound and far-reaching impacts on every NATO nation. It's going to need rearmament. It's going to need to build up. They're going to need to build up their armed forces. They're going to have to address issues of sustainability, logistics, equipment, manpower, training, the whole nine yards. So there's a long way to go before NATO can say it's categorically achieved that. But this is a good start.
So tell me how, describe to us what exactly this number means, 300,000. What does it mean? Who are they? Where will they be deployed? How long does it take to do that?
Well, my understanding, Christiane, is that we're talking, listening to Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General's press conference from yesterday. I think we're talking about each of the enhanced forward battle groups, or the majority. The enhanced forward battle groups, round about 1,000 personnel in Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania and Eastern Poland, and together with another four in Bulgaria, Romania, Slovakia, and Hungary, being reinforced. Certainly, I think we can expect to see the enhanced forward battle groups in the three Baltic states and Eastern Poland being reinforced to become brigade size. Now, brigades are around about 5,000 men and women. So we're talking about four brigades. Now, that's a strong division's worth of NATO in place, ready. This is more than a tripwire. It's becoming a deterrent force. The balance I would expect to see being high readiness and very high readiness forces, probably pre-assigned, kept in the country, maintained in the countries and the states from which they belong, but with pre-based equipment and regular training and exercising so that they can reinforce very quickly if necessary. I don't think we'll see 300,000 yet. We may get to that deployed on NATO's eastern flank. But nevertheless, this is a start.
So let's just be clear also that currently I think there's about 40,000 in this kind of deployment. So this is, as you say, a massive, massive upgrade. And you mentioned the Baltic states. So let me read to you what the Estonian Prime Minister Kaja Kallas said. Last week she said NATO could not protect her country from being wiped off the map. This indeed before this announcement, but if Putin should decide that that would be a target. So describe to us the vulnerability of countries like Estonia and the other Baltic nations.
Well, Kaja Kallas, the admirable Prime Minister of Estonia, is absolutely right that there is no NATO plan that says NATO will defend to the hilt the Baltic states. The NATO plan at the moment is that the Baltic states might be captured by Russia and then NATO would capture them back, which is nonsensical. I hope that we are now going to see a fundamental mindset shift in NATO that says there is going to be a robust plan in place. Many of us have been calling for that for many, many years. That was the purpose of the book I wrote to try and highlight the risks here. So I think that I hope that we'll see that with NATO now, a proper plan put in place to defend the Baltic states. They are really vulnerable. Estonia, 27% Russian-speaking minority. Latvia, 20% Russian-speaking minority. Many of those people will be listening on a regular basis to state-controlled Russian TV and absorbing the Putin poison that he pushes out within Russia and more broadly. So they are vulnerable. And of course, most recently, we've had saber-rattling about Lithuania doing no more than imposing the EU-agreed sanctions on Russian goods going in and out of Kaliningrad. If the Russians were capable of doing so, if they weren't so fixed in the Battle of the Donbass and so desperate to achieve their aims there with their grindingly slow attrition, if they had any spare capacity, I've no doubt that they would try and take on, establish a corridor through through the Suwalki, through Lithuania to the little Russian enclave of Kaliningrad. So they are standing into danger, which highlights the imperative of really effective NATO deterrence.
I mean, as you've been talking, in my mind, I keep hearing the words "not one inch." You know, you've heard NATO leaders, you've heard the Secretary General said, "We will defend every last inch of NATO territory." And there you are saying that NATO has no plan. And Kaja Kallas said as well that NATO countries like the Baltics could be safe. Well, that seems to be undergoing a change, as we've discussed. So my question is, how do you think this will affect Putin? And do you think Putin, given everything he's undergoing in Ukraine, given all the financial pressure on him now, does he still have wider goals outside of Ukraine, do you think?
The answer to your last question is yes, he does. He still sees himself as a new Peter the Great, Catherine the Great, and Stalin, and he would like to preside over a new Russian empire. He said that for 23 years. Now he's a man obsessed with achieving that aim. So if we give him any let up at all, if the siren voices that have been pushing for a ceasefire and Ukraine gives up a fifth of its territory are successful, be under no illusions. Putin will reset, rebuild, reconstitute, and re-engage when he is ready to do so and kick it off all over again. But what impact is this going to have on Putin? This is going to send a very powerful message by NATO to Putin of NATO's strength. And the one thing Russia and Putin respects and fears is strength. Where Putin finds weakness, he probes. He digs in, he exploits it. This is an indication of NATO's strength, providing it is properly backed up. And just picking up your point about planning to recapture Estonia and prevent a capture of it, I bet you now the planners are hard at work putting together a plan together with the forces and the reinforcements needed to protect those Baltic states.
So let's now go to Ukraine itself, where this battle is actually unfolding. We see, and you alluded to it, Putin trying to consolidate. Yes, it's slow. Yes, it's attrition, but consolidating surely, slowly, the eastern part of Ukraine. We spoke in April, we spoke thereafter about a moment and a window of opportunity after their defeats around Kyiv and before they had completely reassembled for the east. A window of opportunity, said people like yourself and Ben Hodges and other experienced military officials, to send Ukraine the weapons they needed. It doesn't look to have happened yet, General Sheriff.
You're absolutely right. We talked about the window of opportunity, that window of opportunity which frequently occurs in any campaign. If you look at any campaign in history, frequently, there's a window of opportunity when the initiative, if grasped, can pass from one to another. I believe firmly that there was that window of opportunity for Ukraine to have taken the initiative after the Battle of Kyiv if the West had taken the shackles off, taken the brakes off the supply of the sort of offensive weaponry, heavy offensive weaponry and aircraft that Ukraine needed. It didn't happen quickly enough. So we are where we are. What about the Battle of the Donbass? Well, as you say, grinding attrition. Severodonetsk now appears pretty much to be in Russian hands, Luhansk Oblast or province in Russian hands. I think we can expect to see a reset by the Russians before they launch a similar battle into the Donetsk, into the other province of the Donbass. And meanwhile, I think we can assume that they will hold defensively in the south. So what? Well, I think now we have to recognize that Ukraine is bleeding. Ukraine has taken heavy casualties. We had 100 to 200 killed a day. Now, if you compute that up by the end of the year, that's at the current rates, that's 35,000 killed. That's significant numbers. Ukraine, if Ukraine is to prevail, if Ukraine is to achieve Zelensky's aim of defeating Putin, which all of us want, Ukraine needs to build up an offensive maneuver capability, which it has not got because it's so stretched. And that is going to be the requirement of the West and NATO. This means building up armored, probably 6 to 9 armored brigades with tanks, armored infantry, artillery, armored engineers, air defense, all the paraphernalia of combined arms operations together with the logistics, the enablers, the long-range precision artillery and missiles that are going to be needed to support them. That is going to take time, and it's going to take a united effort by all of NATO to do so. So let us hope that that is one of the things that will come out very firmly from this NATO summit, a willingness by the West, by NATO, to do what needs to be done to allow the Ukrainians to achieve Russian, to defeat the Russians.
So are you picking up anything, the likes of which are being sort of leaked from Washington and elsewhere, that there are some different thoughts sort of creeping into the calculations of countries like the United States and others? Let me just read to this. No doubt you've been seeing it. You know, advisors to President Biden are debating internally how and if President Zelensky should shift his definition of victory. And you heard yesterday he said to the G7, we must end this, presumably win, by the end of this year. The Biden people mulling the possibility that the country has shrunk irreversibly and that they would not be able to get back the kind of land, whether it's status quo ante to February 23rd, and much less Crimea and what was taken in 2014. Are you picking up any of those doubts now amongst NATO leaders?
I'm not surprised to hear them. I think one has to temper clearly. We all support an ambition that says every Russian soldier is evicted from Ukraine. I think we have to be realistic, and it may just be that that won't completely happen. I mean, for example, Crimea is a case in point. However, I firmly believe that with the right support and the will from the West and from NATO, Zelensky, the Ukrainians, could achieve at least a pushing back of the Russians in the Donbass to the line of the 24th of February. I think we have to accept the Russians are running out of people, they're running out of manpower, they're certainly running out of equipment. President Putin has balked at a general mobilization, which is an indicator of some of the political tensions inside Russia. And one of the reasons he's balked at it because it might not work, which will be a total humiliation. So he's running out of people and manpower, and he's had massive casualties. And he's not only amongst his soldiers, but also among the senior military leadership as well. So the Russians are going to be increasingly on the back foot. And I think we could, providing the West knuckles down and provides what needs to be done, see that balance shift towards Ukraine and away from Russia, which is why I say a reasonable, if Ukraine could inflict a tactical defeat on Putin, which a recapture of the Donbass to the line of the 24th of Feb would mean, that is a tactical defeat which could have a strategic effect.
It's going to take a huge quantum leap jump from NATO countries to enable that to happen, right? I mean, here we heard from Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General today, on a different issue, but one that also is hurting Russia, and that is the finances and the sanctions and the, you know, I guess the trying to cripple the wherewithal that he gets from energy. Here's what he said.
The war in Ukraine shows the danger of being too dependent on commodities from authoritarian regimes. The way Russia is using energy as a weapon of coercion highlights the need to quickly wean off Russian oil and gas.
So do you see that being realistic? Because all we see is the fact that the sanctions have jacked up the price of that oil and gas, that Putin is pulling in huge amounts of money, that the ruble is one of the most stable and strong currencies right now.
Well, I mean, going back to the point where you first started, that last point of the long haul, you're absolutely right. Of course, this ramp up has got to take place at a time when economies are running really hot, when energy prices are going through the roof. And of course, it's only going to get colder in the autumn. And so heating is going to become, and oil and energy is going to become important. But it's a price, I think, that's got to be paid. Easy to say, but this highlights the really vital importance of genuine strategic leadership from our political masters. And I've yet to hear any of our political masters say unequivocally, have the moral courage to step up and say what needs to be done to achieve the sort of peace and security that we all depend on.
Mm-hmm. And I know you've got a frog in your throat. Have a little sip of water. But I want to ask you what you make of the British Army Chief George Sanders, who told a conference today This is our 1937 moment, i.e. the Anschluss, right? The Nazi Anschluss of Austria. We're not at war, but we must act rapidly so that we are not drawn into one through a failure to contain territorial expansion. I mean, you know, I'm sure you agree with that, but I keep trying to figure out the cognitive dissonance. I know the West is giving a lot, money, weapons, all the rest of it. And I know what you're just saying. But Putin is marching on regardless, and he's consolidating in the east there. He has a fifth of Ukrainian territory.
Yeah, well, I agree. I mean, it's good to hear the head of the British Army stand up and say unequivocally that the army's got to be ready to fight. And frankly, it should have been said a long time ago, because that is the purpose of any army. I disagree about 1937. I think actually it's worse than that. I think we're in 1938. And that arguably that the Sudetenland was 2014. The question remains, what is our Poland? And the only way that we can ensure that Putin does not press on to another Poland is to defeat Putin and Putinism. There will be no peace in Europe while he's there. So this brings us back to all the points we've already discussed about effective deterrence, about a change of mindset, right, about rearming, about increased defense expenditure, massive increases in defense expenditure needed. I've not heard, apart from the Germans saying a billion euro into India modernization of the Bundeswehr. Where is Mr. Johnson on this? But he knows Churchill. He's written a book about Churchill. But there's been no hint of any blood, tears, toil and sweat speech from Mr. Johnson. We need that from our political leadership, because that is what is going to take.
Mm-hmm. Right. A lot more, even though a lot is happening right now, is going to take a lot more. General Sir Richard Sheriff, thank you so much. And next, as the anti-abortion movement evolved in the United States, a group of women influenced the strategy and ideology that persists today. Carissa Haugeberg is a historian and author of Women Against Abortion, and she joins Walter Isaacson to trace the history of the movement and those who shaped it.
Thank you, Christian and Carissa Haugeberg. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you.
You and I teach together in the history department of Tulane. One of the things you teach, and you've written a great book about it, is about abortion, women against abortion. Tell me about the anti-abortion movement of the 1960s and how it was led by women.
Okay, so beginning in the 1960s, individual states began to decriminalize abortion in a handful of cases. And in a few more cases, to liberalize their abortion laws. So before the 1960s, many states had very strict abortion laws. They only permitted abortion in the case where a woman's life was at risk. And beginning in the 1960s, there was a movement afoot to grant physicians greater authority to determine when it might be medically necessary, maybe not to save the woman's life, but to preserve her health. So about 17 states liberalized their laws, including, people might be surprised to hear this, many of the states along the eastern seaboard, so including states like North and South Carolina. And it was in these states that were liberalizing their laws or decriminalizing their laws that the anti-abortion movement organized first. And not surprisingly, Catholics really led this movement. They were the only religion in the United States that had been very vehemently opposed to abortion throughout most of its history. So they had the infrastructure, you know, people could meet in church basements to begin organizing. And so a lot of the people who took up this work in these Catholic churches were women. And again, that shouldn't totally surprise us either, because so much of the voluntary work of religious work has been performed by women historically.
What is the role of the clergy and how abortion became decriminalized?
So this is very interesting. In 2022, we tend to think of abortion as being a religious issue only in terms of anti-abortion activism. But when we look back to the 1950s and 1960s, there actually was a very vibrant movement among clergy to assist women to get abortions. The largest of these groups was called the Clergy Consultation Service. And it was a coalition of Protestant clergy, but also rabbis, and even a handful of covert priests working with them, who helped women in states that had really strict abortion laws to get to those states where it was legal and safe. And one thing that's very interesting about this group is they vetted abortion providers. So they would send in decoy women to ensure that the women who arrived at these offices were being treated humanely and weren't being price gouged, which was a huge issue when abortion was criminalized. And it was this coalition of clergy, they practiced rather openly, so they didn't hide the work that they were doing. And they characterized it as work that should not be shameful. And so some historians say that this is a very important turn of the tide to work so openly in support of abortion rights. And it was these clergy who, along with public health physicians, who testified in front of state legislatures about the folly of criminal abortion laws. They talked about young, desperate women coming into their parishes, desperate for information, afraid to talk to their parents about what they were going through. And so it was their testimony that was incredibly compelling to state legislators.
But on the other side, in your book, what really interested me is that there were a lot of people on the anti-war progressive left who were anti-abortion, against abortion, and in favor of laws restricting abortion in the 60s coming out of that movement. Tell me about that.
Absolutely. It's this fascinating moment in the history of Catholicism where in the 1960s, people may find this interesting, Republicans actually were slightly more inclined to favor abortion rights than Democrats. And one of the major reasons for that slight disparity was that Catholics were overwhelmingly Democrats. And so here you have a church that is historically anti-abortion, but in the 1960s, in the wake of Vatican II, have taken up a host of progressive issues. They're concerned about regime changes throughout Central America. There are aggressive anti-poverty campaigns. Catholics are front and center in the movement to oppose American engagement in Vietnam. And so a lot of people identified in so many ways as being progressive, except for the issue of abortion. And so a lot of the women that I studied considered themselves to be Democrats, identified as feminists, and not in a cynical way. They truly believed in women's equality, but for this issue of abortion. And there's this interesting parallel that we could make to the way in which abortion politics got sorted out within both the Republican and Democratic Party. There was a long tradition of there being pro-choice Republicans and anti-abortion Democrats. And by the mid-1990s, those became almost untenable positions.
How did this sorting out happen?
So among the big changes in anti-abortion activism, it occurred in the 1980s as evangelical Christians flooded into the movement, espousing much more conservative ideas about proper gender roles, but also the role of government in ordinary people's lives. And in this debate between progressive Catholics and more conservative evangelicals, the evangelicals certainly won the day. They're the ones whose worldview now shapes the Republican Party.
Let's talk about some of the women who were against abortion, the women anti-abortion activists in your book, because I was surprised at how important women were to leading the anti-abortion movement. Can we start with Marjorie Mecklenburg?
Marjorie Mecklenburg, absolutely. She got her mark in establishing crisis pregnancy centers, which are now ubiquitous and just pretty much the centerpiece of the anti-abortion movement nationwide. So she helped to bring those in. They had initially started in Canada, and she imported them into the United States. And then she got a key post in the Department of Health and Human Services in the Reagan administration, right about the time that abortion became a litmus test for getting these political appointments. And she helped to remake Title X funding. She cut funding from groups that provided comprehensive sex education, and she started to steer federal money into these crisis pregnancy centers. So we really start to see the blending of federal money and the anti-abortion movement in her tenure in the Health and Human Services. And part of the hallmark of women like Marjorie Mecklenburg in the anti-abortion movement is they started to reframe the way the anti-abortion movement was approaching this issue. They tried to characterize their work as being in service to women. So rather than depicting women who got abortion as being fundamentally sinful or evil, they wanted to depict these women as being in need of help. So as victims of a cold system, of unscrupulous physicians. And so these crisis pregnancy centers were intended to offer help to women in crisis, hence crisis pregnancy centers. And historians who look back at this period see this as a crucial turning point now.
A lot of people think that they were kind of, that these type of centers were kind of ruses where they'd lure women in who wanted an abortion and then try to talk them out of it. But these crisis pregnancy centers were really key to the anti-abortion movement.
Right. So once they started to receive federal and then state money, they began to publish tracts that looked like legitimate scientific tracts. If you were to read some of these journal articles that purport that, for example, abortion can cause breast cancer or that abortion causes long-term psychological harm, a lot of these tracts look like legitimate journal articles. They have footnotes and citations. And what most ordinary people who encounter this literature don't understand is that these are not legitimate. These are physicians who are citing one another. They're not representing the consensus view of the American Medical Association or the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Rather, it's this cottage industry of physicians, many of whom are not even actually formally trained obstetricians and gynecologists. Many of them are just general practitioners. But nevertheless, it was in these centers that the distribution of these materials began. And what's kind of diabolical about it is that the claims made in this literature actually made it into Supreme Court decisions. When we look at major Supreme Court decisions, including Gonzales v. Carhart, they cite some of the material that came out of this cottage industry, saying things that, although there's no evidence to support it, it's reasonable to assume that women are traumatized by their abortion. That's a line straight out of this cottage industry.
Another interesting woman in your book is Dr. Mildred Jefferson, who I think was the first African-American to graduate from Harvard Medical School. Tell me about her impact on the anti-abortion movement.
So one thing that's very interesting is Dr. Mildred Jefferson, similar to Marjorie Mecklenburg, were both Methodists. And they came of age in the anti-abortion movement at this crucial stage when they were trying to enlarge themselves and to not just be regarded as a fringe Catholic movement. And Mildred Jefferson did other things for the movement. It was easy to criticize the anti-abortion movement as largely being a white, male-dominated movement. And to have this professional black woman come forward was incredibly important to the movement. And it gave them some cachet and some cover for these arguments, that these common criticisms of their movement. And one argument that she made was she really emphasized the way in which women of color have historically had a disproportionate number of abortions in the United States. And she tied this all the way back to the history of enslavement, when black women didn't have control over their reproduction. And it was her concern that welfare policies would incentivize black women being required to take birth control, something that actually has occurred. But she was also worried that abortion provision would be disproportionately centered in communities of color. And it is true, to this day, women of color have more abortions per capita than white women. However, women of color are more likely to be pro-choice than white women. And women of color are less likely to have reliable access to birth control. So women of color and their access or their reliance on abortion is due to a whole host of issues unrelated to a targeting of abortion services in their communities.
You spoke about how the progressive anti-war left movement of the 1960s, there was a strand of that that played into the anti-abortion movement. Tell me about people like Julie Lesh.
So Julie Lesh is a fascinating character. She's among that cohort of Catholics who was opposed to war and worked on a number of anti-poverty initiatives and then opposed abortion. And she was just this remarkable organizer. She had lists of activists who could be called upon to demonstrate. So, for example, she led this really fascinating campaign at the Pentagon in opposition to both the Vietnam War and to abortion. And she and her allies showed up and poured fake blood on the steps of the Pentagon in this dual protest. And she was also very opposed to the proliferation of nuclear weapons. So she formed a group called Pro-Lifers for Survival that was meant to both tackle the issues of nuclear proliferation and abortion. And again, whereas she was like great at the theatrics, things that would actually become commonplace in the anti-abortion movement, she had a hard time really making this a mass movement. But very quickly, the leaders of Operation Rescue, which was getting going in the late 1970s and early 1980s, they recognized in her that she was really good at creating these really theatrical demonstrations that courted the press, that would get people to show up and take pictures. So they hired her really early on, understanding that she was a good organizer. And it's kind of a tragic story. They really took advantage of her. She helped to coordinate some very massive campaigns, that turned out thousands of people to protest abortion, for example, to protest the 1984 DNC meeting that landed thousands of people in jail and was on the nightly news. But they very quickly cleaved her out of positions of power. They had little interest in her work to oppose nuclear proliferation and to tackle poverty. So they extracted from her what they wanted, which was strategies for protesting, lists of potential volunteers, but then basically cut her out and they underpaid her. They started to deliberately exclude her from key meetings. And so her tenure in the movement kind of ends with her getting married and just going off and having children. But it's kind of a deflated end to her career in that movement.
The movement becomes much more activist, much more assertive. Tell me about the rescue movement or Army of God.
So beginning in the mid-1980s, the anti-abortion movement becomes much more aggressive and assertive. And historians who look back at this moment see a lot of people who are very frustrated. It appears that there's little traction to overturn Roe v. Wade. Efforts to enact a human life amendment into the Constitution completely stall out in committee, again, because of the presence of pro-choice Republicans on those committees. And so there are a group who start to see that the only way out is through extra legal means, that they need to persuade ordinary Americans of the folly of abortion. And they need to just give up on some of the more traditional levers of enacting change through Congress or through the courts. So it's these group of people who begin to stalk abortion providers, to chain themselves to clinics, to intimidate patients who try to enter these clinics, and even to go into the neighborhoods of providers and clinic staff by doing things like posting wanted posters in their neighborhoods to try to shame them out of this provision. And one element of activism that I think is overlooked, but quite terrifying, is that they even went into the schools of clinic staff and providers' children and did things like post pictures of their parents and said, do you know that Billy's mom kills babies and that sort of thing. So it was very intimidating and very personal.
You've written about how the anti-abortion movement does not end, you don't think, with the overturning of Roe. What do you think happens next?
I think that the anti-abortion movement is incredibly energized and hopeful about the future. One thing that they are prepared to do is to fight at both the state level to ensure that those states that do not have trigger laws but are maybe purple states will pass legislation to make it more difficult to get an abortion or to ban it outright. But they also have their sights set on the federal level. And again, this is a moral imperative to them. It is their goal to have an abortion-free nation. But I would also caution, it is their goal to have an abortion-free world. If we look at international policy in the George W. Bush administration, there was an effort to stamp out comprehensive sex education. and funding for abortion and international aid. So this isn't something that stops in the United States.
Carissa Hageberg, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Walter.
And let's not forget that this is a battle about the most draconian, the most wholesale reversal of American women's rights ever. And finally tonight, an Ice Age discovery, unearthing a prehistoric giant. This 35,000-year-old baby woolly mammoth is the first whole and most mummified mammoth ever found in North America. A gold miner clearing the permafrost in the aptly named Eureka Creek in Canada made this chance discovery recently. And the body is nearly perfectly preserved, with skin and hair intact, and a blade of grass was found in its stomach. Extraordinary. That's it for now. And if you ever miss our show, you can find the latest episode shortly after it airs on our podcast. On your screen now is a QR code. All you need to do is pick up your phone and scan it with your camera. You can also find it at cnn.com/podcast and on all major platforms. Just search Amanpour. And remember, you can always catch us online, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thank you for watching and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.